summer sermon series on the Proverbs, and I have a feeling that the Proverbs for many people are not a very well-known book. In fact, there's a lot of people who might not be able to find it in the Bible. It's in the Old Testament. It's part of the wisdom literature, and it's part of wisdom literature because the Proverbs are many statements, hundreds of statements that are intended to make us wise, to impart wisdom on us so we live life well. If you've read through the Proverbs, you'll know that it's a strange book. It doesn't read like a lot of other books. It's not a letter. It's not a narrative. It's hundreds of statements about work, about friendship, about marriage, about sex, about raising children, about anger. And we're going to dwell in those together week by week and receive that wisdom as a community. As we often say at the beginning of series, if you're looking to travel with us to the Proverbs, we encourage you to make it your devotions, make it something you read around the dinner table with your family, make it something that you read as a couple. It's a rich book, and your whole study of it will be enriched as we preach and read through it together. I'm going to be overviewing our series this morning, but I'll also be preaching on the beginning of Proverbs. So turn with me, if you have a Bible, to Proverbs 1. I'm going to read the first 7 verses. The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for gaining wisdom and instruction, for understanding words of insight, for receiving instruction in prudent behavior, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning. And let the discerning get guidance for understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Brittany and I travel back to Ontario every summer to visit and spend time with my family that lives there. And when we're in Ontario, we usually make a point of catching up with our old university friends that we studied with a long time ago. We usually find a restaurant to go to and listen to their story and catch up on how our families are doing. And on one such occasion, 3 years ago now, I sat with a friend that I studied with and lived with and knew very well, and I asked him, "How was your year? Tell me about your life." And he summarized for me what was a very difficult year. He said to me that he went through a very significant crisis of faith, that he had an unexpected job change that was a difficult transition for him, and he shared that his wife got pregnant, and then she found out very quickly that there's a lot of complications, and they lost their baby. And as I was sitting there just processing a very challenging year for this young man, he said to me in a strong statement of honesty, he said, "You know, life is way harder than I thought it was going to be." Does that resonate with you? I think for the vast majority of us, as we get older and we reflect on how life actually goes, we realize that that's really true. Life is a lot harder than we thought it was going to be when we were young. The degree that you spent thousands and thousands of dollars on doesn't get you the job that you thought it would. The job you do end up getting is a lot harder and perhaps mindless than you thought. Your family relationships are fraught with complexity and pain and tension that you didn't understand. Your marriage that you thought was going to be so easy is fraught with tension and conflict that you don't know where it came from. Your kids, they make decisions that break your heart. Your friends, they let you down and they hurt you in ways they don't even understand, and you experience loneliness. You have doubts in your faith. Fill in the blanks. Life is harder than you thought it was going to be. And it seems to me that most of us, as we go through the complexity of life, what we long for, perhaps without even articulating it, is wisdom, don't you think? The thing that we want is to navigate through this messy, complex, unfair world well, and not just survive, but to thrive. And in order to do that, we need wisdom. And that's what Proverbs is all about. It seems to me that unique challenges that you and I face living in Canada is that we live in a culture that is by no means known for raising people in wisdom. It's not a culture that's known right now for forming young hearts to navigate well through the world. And Dallas Willard, in one of his books, and I actually underlined this immediately after I read it, he writes this about Christians in our culture. "Superficiality is the curse of our age. Do you believe that? The doctrine of instant satisfaction is the primary spiritual problem, and the desperate need, he writes today, is not for intelligent people, nor for gifted people, but for deep people, for those who are wise. And the scriptures, as we'll see in just a few moments, they describe the wise person, the wise community. They are the people who know how to navigate through the broken, complex messiness of life. Well, that's what it means to be wise. And the guiding question that we want to be asking week after week as we go through this summer series on the Proverbs is, how do we become those people? How do we become the wise people who navigate through the unfairness and the complexity of our broken world well? How do we get wisdom? That's what we'll be looking at. And I have to say, as we begin this series, a prayer of mine for all of us, whatever circumstances you face, whatever brokenness you're in the midst of, whatever complexity you're struggling with, my prayer is that we have a hunger for wisdom, that God plants in us a desire, a deep desire, to be faithful and rooted in the midst of that mess. And I say that specifically for our young. I don't know if you know the book of Proverbs, but you'll notice that a good chunk of Proverbs is actually written from a father's standpoint to his son. And it's written to sort of instruct that son as they go out and embark on the journey of life. And that father wants nothing more for his son than wisdom. And so to our young, I say, may God grant you the hunger for wisdom as we go through this series. Now, our passage begins by introducing us to the man named Solomon, who is really the character that most of the Proverbs in this book are attributed to. And Solomon is, I would say, the epitome of wisdom in the Old Testament. He's the hero of wisdom among Israelites. And if you know, at the beginning of his ministry, he prays not for power. He doesn't pray for money. He doesn't pray for influence. But what does he pray for? Wisdom. And God is so taken by this king's prayer for wisdom that he gives him that lavishly. And Solomon, from the beginning of his ministry, after this prayer, is known not just by the Israelites, but by surrounding nations as this exceedingly wise leader who understands the complexity of the world and brings his faith to bear on all these different parts of life, from marriage to family to children to anger to words. There's so much wisdom there. Now, I will say, if you know the story of Solomon, he could have used some of his own wisdom in the area of marriage. I don't know if you know the number of wives he had. It's not seven. It's not 70. It's 700. And that just seems foolish and excessive on so many levels. But this book comes from Solomon, who is given the gift of wisdom in every area except for marriage. Read it for yourself, you know what I mean. Read 2 Kings. Now, I want to ask the question. You'll see that this is the book of collection of proverbs. What is a proverb? Does anyone know? What's a proverb? A proverb is, according to many people, a sort of short, punchy statement, a comparison, a sort of a way of understanding a relationship between two things that is meant to prick you into reflection about your character, about the way the world works, about what you need to do to live well. A proverb is meant to make you stop and reflect. And every country, every culture has proverbs, and I know our own does. I'm curious, for those of us from other cultures, I'm curious what the proverbs of your culture are. But some that I grew up with, and maybe you did too, are: beauty is in the eye of the beholder. Have you heard that one? Or birds of the same feather flock together, the reason why there's so many cliques in the world. Or the one that my parents would say to me, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. That's a proverb. Or this is one I just learned recently: lies travel around the world while truth is putting on her boots. And biblical proverbs, they operate in much the same way. They're these short, punchy statements that are meant to cause you to say, ah, that is worth reflecting on. Here are just a few biblical proverbs that we're going to go through over the next few months. Like a city whose walls are broken through is a person who lacks self-control. Wounds from a friend can be trusted while the enemy multiplies kisses. A good name is more desirable than riches. To be esteemed is more valuable than silver and gold. A wife of noble character, who can find? She is worth more than rubies. Walk with the wise and become wise, for a companion of fools suffers harm. And many of these phrases, and there's hundreds of these, spoken at the right time to the right person in the right context, they cause that person to say, ah, that's who I want to be. That's the decision I want to make. That's the character I want to have. That's how I want to be understood by my community. That's how I receive wisdom. That's what the Proverbs are after. And a really fundamental question that we're going to open up this morning is, what does it mean to be wise? I mean, what comes to your mind right now when you think of the word wisdom? What do you picture? Old. That's about right. We're going to come back to that in just a minute. I think a lot of us might picture an old person with a beard sitting in a chair contemplating life. Or perhaps you picture, and a lot of people do this, you picture someone who's really smart. They have a high IQ. But I think we should know that wisdom is by no means intelligence. In fact, I'm guessing a lot of us know an intelligent person who makes very foolish decisions. A young woman I studied with in university, she got this incredible scholarship to study at Oxford for a year with some of the brightest minds that this special program brought from around the world. So all these smart philosophy and English students studied at Oxford for the special year of smart people studying smart things. And she came back from that year, and I said, how did it go being with all these bright minds and high-flying thoughts? And she said, you know, it was actually pretty discouraging because the majority of the students she studied with were atheists. Many of them were self-described nihilists, and they didn't see much hope for the future. They didn't have much sense of purpose in the world, and the majority of their time outside of the classroom was in the pub getting drunk or in their homes getting high. And she said, that was a tough year. So wisdom is not intelligence. In the scriptures, the word for wisdom in the Old Testament, the Hebrew word is chokmah. Can you say that? Chokmah. If you say it enough, you'll definitely, you know, send phlegm onto your knee. But that word is used in Exodus 31 to describe a craftsman building the tabernacle. And as he builds and he shapes and he builds something beautiful, he is described as displaying chokmah. And chokmah, I think, is best described as skillful living. Being wise in the scriptures is having practical know-how. In many ways, I think of farmers who just learn how to fix everything on their own. Farmers have wisdom when it comes to working the land, knowing their crop, understanding the seasons. They show wisdom. A musician who makes beautiful music is displaying chokmah. A mother who's raising her children skillfully and showing them how to live and raising them wisely is displaying chokmah. Peter Lighthart, who writes a lot on the Proverbs, he writes this beautiful sentence on what they're all about. He said, the Proverbs teach us how to live skillfully. They teach us how to construct a life that is attractive, fitting, and beautiful. I love all three of those words. The Proverbs teach us how to construct a life that is attractive, it is fitting, and it is beautiful. And what he's after there, and this is a very important point, that our world is not an arbitrary place. The way this world is not arbitrary. The way that humans are, the way we were put in this world, is not something that we just arbitrarily decide how to relate. There's a design to our world, and there's a design to relationships, and there's a design to how we're supposed to navigate our way through it. And there's a way of the fool that Proverbs describes is you just go your own route. You decide for yourself how to live. You decide for yourself how to be in relationship, how to live in this world. And that's going to lead, as the Proverbs say, to destruction, pain, and misery. And the wise people are those who live in tune with how they were created. The wise person knows that there's a God who designed this world, and he designed humans to work in a certain way. And when you see that, and I hope we've all had moments where we're with someone we describe as wise, and we see a life that is attractive, it's fitting, and it's beautiful. Before Brittany and I got married, we actually shared a few meals with people in our church at the time. And one of those couples we spent time with, they're an older couple, their kids had moved out of the house, and we shared a meal with them, we listened to their story, we got to know them, and as we're listening to them, we just listened to their life, the way they did their work, the way they raised their kids, they lived as a married couple. I remember us leaving that home thinking, that's what we want for ourselves. There's something about that home, that life, their marriage, the way they've raised their kids, that's what we want our home, our marriage, our life to look like. And what we saw there was skillful living. We saw people whose lives were in tune with how they were created, and it was attractive and fitting and beautiful. I hope I'm already whetting your palate for wisdom. Now, one of the qualifications we want to make in this series, and this is a very significant way of reading the book of Proverbs, is that this is not a book of absolute guaranteed promises all the time. The book of Proverbs establishes general foundational truth for life. And it gives us a sense of, if we do this, this is how life will go generally. But there are always exceptions to the rule, and this will keep you from stumbling through this book in painful ways. Let me give you a really helpful example. One of the most well-known Proverbs is Proverbs 22:6. Anyone know it? Teach a child in the way they should go, and when they're older, they will not depart from it. And the instruction there is raise your kids to know Christ, teach them the faith, embody the faith before them, and when they're older, they'll take up that faith, they'll live it out, and teach the next generation. That's Proverbs 22:6. Does that always happen? All the time? No. And when we see kids, there are some kids, and I think some of us were those kids, who rebel against our parents. We rebel against the faith of our church, and we go our own way, and we don't look at Proverbs 22:6 and say to the parents, well, that's a fail. You've really failed in raising your kids to know Christ. No, there are exceptions. And if you read the book of Ecclesiastes, it's one ongoing critique of the incongruity of life and why the wicked flourish and the faithful don't. This is a book, Proverbs, of general foundational truth for which there are exceptions. Now, in this first seven verses, we see that there are three particular characters that emerge. The first character is the young, to whom most of the Proverbs are written. And young, don't be offended by this. That's also paired with being simple. Let me read it for you. The Proverbs are given for prudence to those who are simple, knowledge and discretion to those who are young. And it is assumed in the Proverbs that the young are the people who do not yet know how to faithfully live. They don't yet know their place in God's vast, complex world. They don't understand necessarily the kind of character that's needed, the decisions that they'll need to make, the complexity that faces them. And what is needed for the young is people to instruct them, to impart wisdom on them, is them to receive discipline and teaching from those who are older and wise. And the great irony, of course, is everyone knows this except for the young, especially teenage young. And what's really, I'll say this again to our young, is what's so significant in the Proverbs is this constant call to humility and to being someone who does not in arrogance push back on instruction and to those who surround you in love, but to listen in humility to those who've gone before you and know a thing or two about the character that you need to live faithfully in the world. That's the first character. The second character is the wise, and we see right after this it says, let the wise listen and add to their learning, let the discerning get guidance. The wise are not described in Proverbs as those who just revel in their own wisdom, revel at how much more they know than those simple learners, those young people. But the wise are actually described here as those who pursue learning, those who constantly seek greater levels of wisdom and understanding. And I like that because anyone who's old should know enough that you never arrive, right? You never get to a place where you're like, now I'm wise. Now I've got it. Now I can coast in this level of understanding. The wise are marked by the pursuit of wisdom, the pursuit of growing and understanding, and also, as we'll see in many Proverbs, to then pass that on to the next generation, to pass on what they've learned, their insight, their modeling of character to the next generation of simple young people so they can take up their place and pursue wisdom alongside of them. The third character, which shows up throughout the Proverbs, is in the end of verse 7 where it says, fools despise wisdom and instruction. The foolish show up a lot because in the ancient world, just like today, foolishness is not hard to find. Fools are described as those who resist and reject instruction. They're those who are proud and arrogant and self-sufficient. They don't need other people telling them how to live. They'll do their own thing, thank you very much. And over again, the fool is described as leading a life that will destroy, bring ruin, and pain, not just to the person, but to the community. That's the way of the fool. And Proverbs, in many ways, is teaching the young and saying to them, there's the way of the wise right there, and there's the way of the fool right there. Do not go the way of the fool. And again, I say to the young of our own church here this morning, do not go the way of the fool. And in Canada, I would say that foolishness is not just tolerated, it's celebrated. And I find that to be a striking feature of our culture. And if you don't believe me, just turn on your TV. Pick a random set of Netflix shows, and I'll illustrate for you foolishness. And what strikes me the most, and I find this alarming, is that so many shows right now, comedies, they are depicting people in their midlife I can't even think of a title right now, but there's many people in their midlife, and they have this sort of existential crisis of existence. They find it boring just to raise kids and do the job faithfully. And what do? They throw caution to the wind, they blow their money, they buy the nice car, and they party, and they try to have fun. They try to be fools. And the whole show is celebrating people who should be wise, debasing themselves in foolishness. And those are the shows that always hit the box office and get lots of people packing up the theaters. And I think, how do we live in a culture that celebrates foolishness? And so I say to the young, hunger for wisdom. Do not go the path of least resistance, which is the path of the fool. Do not sit in selfless arrogance and resist the instruction of your community of faith. Choose wisdom. Now the center of Proverbs 1 to 7 is verse 7. And you'll see it right at the bottom of the screen. This comes at the end of Proverbs as well. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. And that's repeated at the end of Proverbs when it talks about the woman of noble character. It says, she is wise because she fears the Lord. Even in Ecclesiastes, a book that looks at all the unfairness and injustice of the world, it finishes by saying, when all has been heard, fear God and keep his commands. And I'm well aware that even in our crowd this morning, you think of that phrase, fear the Lord. What does that mean? Do I fear him the way I fear getting fired? Do I fear him the way I fear my angry father? Do I fear him in a way that I understand fear in our culture today? And we realize that in the Old Testament, fear has a much wider resonance of meaning. Fear in the Old Testament is to revere. Is that a word that has some traction? To revere someone? Fear is this basic disposition, I think, we recognize that God is God, and we are not. God is sovereign, powerful, as capable, creator, redeemer, and we are not. And perhaps a good word that goes along with fear is awe. We have an awe towards God. And it seems to me that if there is a fear of God in us, the central disposition that we find ourselves in then is a sort of humble submission to God. If we understand that God is God and he sets then the rules for marriage, friendship, the way we live with our money, the way we live with our words, the way we work, the way we live in leisure, if he's the one who sets the terms for all those things, he designed them, fearing God is a posture of humble listening before him. And one of the challenging things that came to me this week is the barometer for us of how we fear him, if we fear him, is prayer. I'm convinced that someone who prays is someone who fears the Lord. Why would you pray otherwise? Someone who does not pray, they don't need God. Someone who is completely self-sufficient, they know how to rule their lives, they want to do what they do, they don't need prayer. But someone who develops a discipline of prayer is someone who recognizes that God is God and I am not. Prayer is a barometer of fear. And let me just ask you right out now, in the situations that you face right now, the complexities that are beyond your comprehension, where does the fear of God fit into that? Where does the humble submission before him, the listening, the submission, the wanting to hear him speak in his word, in prayer, in his community, where is that in the current situations you face right now? Where does fear exist? And if there's any hang-ups on what it means to fear the Lord, I want to finish by talking about the fact that the God that we're called to revere, to awe, to humble ourselves before is the God who loves us so much and is so for us that when we reject the law he gives us in the Old Testament, when we reject the wisdom he gives us in the Old Testament, when we reject the prophets he gives us in the Old Testament, he gives us himself. The God who created us, who designed our world, who wants us to live skillfully is so for us doing that, that he gives us himself. Christ in the flesh is, as Paul describes in 1 Corinthians, the wisdom of God. And I want to read for you what Paul says just a few books later in Colossians 2. This is what Paul says. My goal is that they, the church, may be encouraged in heart, united in love, that they may have the full riches of complete understanding, in order that they may know the mystery of God, namely Christ, in whom are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and understanding. Did you hear that? That in Christ are hidden all the treasures of wisdom and understanding. Now, what that means for us is that when we pursue Christ, the one who frees us by his death and resurrection, when we follow our lives after him, it will make us wise. to pursue Christ is to model our lives after the one who is perfectly wise, who embodied full chokmah and skillful living. As we model our lives after him, we will become the people whose lives are attractive, fitting, and beautiful. Is that making sense? Let me give an illustration that I think puts some flesh on this. In Toronto, there's a couple, a young couple that got engaged and wanted to be married, and they lived near this little church. It was one of these quaint little churches that every young couple wants to be married in. And so they approached the pastor, and they said to the pastor, "Can you marry us in this church?" And the pastor said, "Well, let's talk. Let's get to know each other. Are the two of you believers? Are you Christians?" And they said, "No." And the woman shared quite openly that she's a professor of U of T, a women's studies professor, and she had a lot of issues with the faith. And she said, "We just want to be married here." And so what do you think the pastor said? He said, "How about this? I'll marry you in a civil wedding. It won't be a Christian wedding. I'll do a civil marriage for you if you do pre-marriage counseling with me." So the couple said, "Sure. We love this church. We love that steeple. We want that photo. We'll do the pre-marriage counseling." So they sat with the pastor who gave them week after week a vision of the Christian view of marriage, a vision for how to live out marriage bonds in the context of a community of faith, of covenant faithfulness that's not rooted in just emotional affection, but long-term covenant bound. After this, the couple got married, and just a few weeks after that, they showed up at the church on a Sunday morning. More out of curiosity, now that they heard about what Christians believe and what they say about marriage, they were curious to see, what does that look like in this tiny, quaint little church? And they showed up once, got to know a few people. They showed up again, they got invited over for a meal, and they got to know a family in the church. And they kept coming back, and slowly but surely, they became part of the furniture at that church. They got to know the families, and fast forward a whole year, they said to the pastor, "We want to be Christians." The pastor sits down with them and says, "Well, can you just share that journey with me?" And they said, "Well, we wanted to know what the Christians looked like in church. And we got to know some couples, we got to know some families, and we started comparing notes. Because we got a whole set of friends in the city of Toronto, and then we see these Christians living this way." And they said, "You know, at the end of the day, these are the people we want to be friends with. There's something about their lives that we want for our life. There's something about their families we want to see for our families." And what was so striking is this woman who taught women's studies and had a strong feminist bent, she said, "When I see the way these married couples live, in faithful fidelity, in mutual care, in mutual concern, that was compelling." And they saw what I would say is the chokmah of the church. As they pursued Jesus in community, as they raised their kids in community, as they lived their married lives in community, this new couple saw skillful living. And it was beautiful and fitting and attractive. My prayer for Hope Community Church is exactly that. That the visitors who may even be here this morning would see in our community, from our young people to our old people, from singles to marrieds, to everyone in this community, they would see skillful living that lives in juxtaposition to the celebrated foolishness of culture. They see covenant commitment. They see people who, as they pursue Jesus, the wisdom of God fills our lives by his Spirit and creates skillful living that creates harmony and shalom and draws people in. That's where the Proverbs points us. That's why it's good news. Let's pray.